This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. On today's show, Greece is in a profound economic crisis. International creditors offered a deal that would demand serious cutbacks, serious austerity measures. Well, this past Sunday, the Greeks said no, they will not accept this deal. Now, what is this really about? Trumpet writer Richard Palmer says that really Greece is standing up to the Germans. For the last 5 years, Germany has dominated the Eurozone. Der Spiegel calls it an economic Fourth Reich. But the Greeks have essentially exposed the limits of Germany's power. This has huge implications for the future of the Eurozone, the future of Europe. This is a situation we need to be watching very closely. We're going to talk today to Richard about what we might expect to see in the time ahead. Our second item, an astonishing outcome of America's muddled Middle East policy. U.S. forces are in Iraq trying to help Iraqi forces fight the Islamic State. And guess who else is there? Iranians. A lot of them. An unbelievable news item reported recently from Bloomberg View. Iran's forces and U.S. share a base in Iraq. Apparently, some of these Iranian fighters have killed Americans. They are spying on them even today. We'll talk with Anthony Chibatoway about what in the world is going on here. In AD 79, Mount Vesuvius erupted and buried the people of Pompeii, creating one of the most dramatic archaeological sites ever found. Now, the interesting thing is there are about 3.5 million Italians living in that same area today, and Vesuvius is still an active volcano. We're going to talk with trumpet writer Robert Morley about a lesson that we can learn from these people living in the shadow of a disaster waiting to happen. We're also going to answer questions from our listeners, and I'll finish off today's show by talking about a man who tried to change the world by translating the world's most important book. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Our top story today, we are going to look at Greece and this economic crisis. It's been rolling for a while, but it is reaching a breaking point. Last week, the country shut the banks down in an effort to stop the bleeding. This past Sunday, they held a referendum to decide would they accept a deal from their international creditors? Would they accept all of the austerity measures that this would involve? Well, this past Sunday, Greek voters said, no, we will not accept it. So what happens next in this country? I have Richard Palmer from our office in the United Kingdom with me via Skype. He's going to help us to make sense of what's happening there. Richard, you have an article ready to go up on thetrumpet.com that says this is a major milestone in the euro crisis. Can you tell us what's going on and why this is so important for us to watch?
Yes. So what this referendum and the Greeks' results represent is a major threat to Germany's core interests. For a long time now, Germany has been building up what has even been termed an economic empire. Spiegel wrote an article recently, one of the most important news magazines in Germany, where they called it an economic Fourth Reich. And now the Greeks have rejected that. And more than just rejecting that, the way they've rejected it threatens the core interests of Germany. And it's going to force a very interesting response in time from Germany. Now, what those core interests are, they're the same interests that Germany's been pursuing throughout the euro crisis. Firstly, the single currency has enabled Germany's export miracle. And we've talked a fair bit at the Trumpet about how Germany has this huge booming economy with a really strong export market, really strong manufacturing sector. It is the euro, and specifically it is the presence of Southern Europe within the euro that has allowed that to happen. It means that Southern Europe have easy access to German goods and cheap access to German goods, so Germany can keep selling lots of things to Southern Europe. And they also mean that Germany's currency is weaker than it would be otherwise, making it easier for Germany to sell to the world, So without the Southern Europe in the Eurozone, German goods suddenly become much more expensive. Their economic miracle grinds to a halt. Their unemployment, that's spectacularly low right now, starts shooting up, and they're in big economic trouble. The second core aim that Greece's vote threatens is to protect taxpayers' money. So they want to be in the Eurozone. What they don't want to be doing, though, is paying off the debts of Southern European countries. They don't want to become liable for the debts of Southern European countries. And so now Greece is threatening both of those. There's the potential that they could leave the euro, and there's the potential they could leave the euro in such a way that it saddles Germany with all of their debts, or at least a good chunk of them. Now, it's important to recognize it may take some time for it to become obvious that these core interests are being threatened. Greece itself does not directly threaten them. So if Greece leaves the eurozone, or if Greece leaves Germany with those debts, Greece's economy isn't big enough to do a huge amount of harm to Germany. However, the big worry is that they will set the precedent for the rest of Europe. So if they leave the eurozone, and in a year or two, they're doing really well, their unemployment problems are over, their economy is booming, then Spain, then Italy, then Portugal, they're going to start thinking, well, maybe we'd be better off outside the eurozone too. And then that starts threatening a core German interest.
That seems like a bigger deal. Like Greece's influence on the eurozone would be of, say, a certain amount of concern. But the way that this would affect these other European countries, that adds a whole other dimension to it. The precedent that is set here then begins to bleed over into these other even larger European economies.
That's exactly right. The danger from Greece isn't from Greece itself. It's that Greece could blaze a trail for other southern European countries to follow. And the same is true for their debts. If they leave the eurozone in such a way that Germany is saddled with all of their debts, then Portugal, then Italy, then Spain could look at doing exactly the same thing.
The problems that we see in the Greek economy, really, these are being experienced by economies all over Europe, just maybe not quite to such an extreme degree.
Right, and even in some cases, to just as an extreme degree. And Europe likes to talk as though the crisis is over. If you look at unemployment rates in Spain, especially youth unemployment in Spain, is actually higher than Greece. So I think we tend to forget in some ways just how serious the crisis is in these other European countries, which means that it could very easily spread to these much bigger economies.
So you know that German economists, that German politicians and other high-ranking European politicians are watching this situation with Greece and realizing that this is not by any means isolated to this one country. This has huge ramifications that would stretch right across the entire eurozone.
Yes, and it has the potential in time to absolutely devastate Germany, to destroy this economic miracle that we've seen. Now, can you imagine the effect on a German government if, say, in the wake of Southern Europe leaving the eurozone, unemployment in Germany doubles in a matter of just a few months? And then at the same time, they're suddenly saddled with an extra 200 billion euros in debt because these other European countries didn't pay their debts back. That's collapse of the government level, mass protests filling the streets level problems.
So it's obvious why Germany has been so, or say why the IMF, why international creditors have been so anxious to try to strike a deal with Greece. But now Greece just said, no, we're not going to participate. So what does this mean?
Right. What Greece's decision has done now is it exposed the limits of German power as it stands at the moment. Germany has been giving Greece orders, as they have all of Southern Europe, in pursuit of those economic aims.
And that's Germany's where we have all of these people in Greece who are saying, making comparisons to Nazi-era German politics and that type of thing, where they really say this is a resurrection of the Third Reich.
Right, and even Germans, as we saw with the Spiegel, are saying this is a resurrection of the Third Reich. Yeah, they've been doing those, and now Greece has turned around and said, well, we're not going to submit anymore. And if Greece can get away with that, the whole of Southern Europe gets away with that, and Germany's Fourth Reich collapses overnight.
So what does Germany do about this?
Exactly. And in this article that I wrote, I quoted a fair bit from George Friedman, the CEO of Stratfor's book, Flashpoints, where he talks about exactly this outcome. And he has some very, very sobering analysis about what happens here. He says, well, how does Germany compel the repayments of debts through purely economic means? And that's a good question. Eventually, people end up better off refusing to pay the debts than keeping on paying them, which is where Greece is now. And he says, this logic here either leads to capitulating economically, which is difficult for the Germans, or moving towards some political option. So he says, ultimately, Germany either accepts the consequence of defeat in the debt game or moves beyond economics. And so that's what Germany is going to be forced to do now. They're absolutely not going to accept these major losses, except being saddled with billions of euros of other people's debt, which means they are going to be forced beyond economics. And so the situation is, if they do not control or at least be able to limit Greece's options, they face economic ruin. But they can no longer control Greece using economic power alone. So they have to move beyond economic power. And then Friedman talks about, he says, wealth without strength is an invitation to disaster. And that is Germany right now. They have wealth. They have many of the components of strength. They don't have strong leadership or the leadership necessary to marshal all of those different aspects of strength into a very strong national policy. And so Friedman's analysis continues. He talks about how Germany, with its vital interests, investments and markets and so on, will become a target and attacks on its interests will escalate. Germany will have a choice of accepting the punishment or using its vast resources to transform wealth into power. And then he concludes, Germany will therefore become a fully fledged power, first flexing its political muscles and in time its military ones as pressure develops.
That's really what we're talking about when we say it's the limits of its economic power forces it to move into other realms, starting with political power and eventually moving into military power.
That's the logical destination of where we're moving. If you look at what we talked about a couple of weeks ago on this program, about Germany and Europe not being able to tolerate Greece going over to Russia or over to a foreign power. Well, how do you do that? If you've reached the point now where they can no longer boss Greece around using economic power, how do you stop them going over to the Russians? Well, you can talk to the Russians, and there's certain good indications that Germany is doing that. But ultimately, it comes down to, can you physically force them to do what you want?
It's an extraordinary situation to watch for. And knowing how much is at stake for Europe as a whole, for the Eurozone in particular, the way that Germany responds to this is definitely something we're going to have to keep our eyes on.
Yes, and it's absolutely something that Mr. Flurry, the editor-in-chief of The Trumpet, has kept his eyes on the whole time on this crisis. In this article, I went back to a 2010 piece where he talked about this. He said, when Germany is strong and the people are alarmed, all of us should be alarmed, especially in a crisis like this. And he talks about how history shows when they feel threatened, they'll turn to strong leaders. And that is where the referendum in Greece is leading. It is leading to Germans feeling threatened, feeling that their economy is threatened, and feeling that their livelihoods are threatened.
Mr. Flurry has been talking quite a bit about the fact that this situation with Greece is really certain to be a catalyst for the European Union being whittled down to a core group of nations, down from what 27 members that it is right now, into something that's much leaner and much more capable of acting as a unified entity.
Another thing we've seen time and time again in this crisis is this 18-member unwieldy Eurozone machine. It has been a farce, almost a joke. You know, even today, you had the new Greek finance minister turning up to the negotiations. Everyone says, well, what's your proposals? He says, oh, actually, I don't have any at the moment. And everyone's gotten incredibly frustrated. And it's not, it clearly is not working the way that they've got it set up right now.
Well, thank you very much for helping us to understand this, Richard. The title of the article, Germany, Greece, and the Fight for the Euro. This is our top story on thetrumpet.com. Watch for this. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you. Good to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
If you want a picture of just how crazy America's Middle East policy has gotten, listen to this. The Islamic State is rampaging through the region. The U.S. wants to stop it. U.S. forces are in Iraq trying to help Iraqi forces battle Islamic State militants. And right beside them, supposedly in alliance, are Iranian fighters. A report last week showed that U.S. and Iranian forces are sharing an air base, what was formerly called Camp Ridgeway, but it's now called Takadum. Apparently, some of these Iranian fighters have killed Americans. They're spying on them even today. What in the world is going on here? I talked with trumpet writer Anthony Chibatoway about this unbelievable story. Anthony, when I saw this article last week, this just blew me away, what the United States is doing here. Can you fill us in on what's happening?
I think this is a very, very important development. It's extremely significant. A brief background about this, just to give you context. For over 36 years, the United States and Iran have not had any diplomatic ties. And that's since 1979 with the Iranian Revolution and the Iran hostage crisis. But now we have military ties. We're sharing a military base with Iran.
So can you tell us about this base? Where is this and what are they doing there?
Okay, this base is located 60 miles west of Baghdad. And it's located between ISIS strongholds, Fallujah and Ramadi. Ramadi recently fell to the Islamic State. And ever since then, the United States has just been stepping up its effort to counter Islamic State in Iraq. The United States recently announced that they'll be sending an additional 450 troops to train Iraqi soldiers there to try to fight the Islamic State. But also at the same time, you also have Iranian-sponsored Shiite militants at that same base, sharing that same base with the United States. And there have been reports that the ties between the two, they're a little hazy. They don't even know exactly how much interaction the United States has with these Iranian-sponsored groups, but they certainly are ties that they have. They are sharing this base.
It's interesting. You have the United States went into Iraq, eliminated Saddam Hussein, cleared everything out, eliminated basically Iran's most powerful enemy in the region, the one that they had fought this war against for practically a decade in the 1980s. It opens the door for much greater power for Iran. Iran floods into Iraq, sends all kinds of forces in there and infiltrating throughout the country. And then the United States leaves and Iran is stepping into the void, and we can watch this happening. And even in the early days of the Gulf War, Donald Rumsfeld famously said, we're not going to allow this to turn into an Iranian colony. But that's really just what has happened. And here you have Iran stepping in and actually using the facilities that the United States established there for its own purposes. Isn't that right?
That's correct. There's a Senator Tom Cotton. He's from Arkansas, and he actually fought in Iraq. And he said that some of the most lethal roadside bombs that were used against the coalition forces during the war in Iraq, they came from Iran. They were used by some of these militants that are now based on this military base that they have.
So this Bloomberg View article from June 22nd says there are some of these Shiite militias at this base who have killed American soldiers in the past. They're the same guys that were fighting us and killing American soldiers that are now working side by side with these Americans.
No wonder why later on in the article it says that some members of the intelligence community have noticed that these same militants are actually spying on U.S. operations on that base. I mean, after all, they're sharing the same base.
So they're watching what the Americans are doing. They're learning about how the Americans conduct themselves, spying on U.S. operations. Really, it seems to me like you have to look at this as yet another instance of America allowing something like this to go on, which should never be going on because they're so afraid of the derailing of the nuclear negotiations. I would assume that has to be at play here.
It's a very complicated situation for the United States, but it needn't be complicated. There's the nuclear negotiations. That's the big problem. That's a big part of the problem. The United States has been bending over backward to just try to accommodate Iran, trying whatever it can do to try to make it look like a good deal. And also, there's also the issue of the Islamic State. Iran is using the Islamic State to its advantage. It's using the problems that these terrorists are causing. I mean, the United States is worried about the Islamic State. So Iran is taking advantage of that. So as long as Iran acts like a partner against the Islamic States, the United States is going to try to accommodate it in some fashion. And that's what we're seeing here.
I'll just read one paragraph from this article. American critics of this growing cooperation between the U.S. military and the Iranian-backed militias call it a betrayal of the U.S. personnel who fought against the militias during the 10-year U.S. occupation of Iraq. That is exactly right. This is a betrayal of those soldiers who fought and died to try to establish some order and to set things right in Iraq. I mean, to me, this is an amazing picture of just how far down the wrong track we have gotten. If we're allowing ourselves to work alongside the Iranians who killed our own men, allowing them to spy on us and to undermine what we're doing over there and really explain. I mean, I think the Iranians must be looking at this and just like so many of the things that America is doing right now must be absolutely incredulous that the United States is conducting its business in this fashion.
And I think one thing that we also need to think about is the fact that this trend is not necessarily new. The trend of the United States warming its relation with Iran is not necessarily anything new. I mean, we are talking with Iran right now in nuclear negotiations, so it's easy for people to think, oh, so what's the big deal with sharing a military base? But this is a lot more serious. People have been killed in these wars.
Yeah, to say it's not new, I mean, what we're seeing, to me, it seems like this is the most grotesque form of the kind of accommodation that we're making with Iran of any that we have ever seen.
Exactly. Politicians can easily push brushes aside as just a trend, yet another development in this relationship, but this is a lot more serious.
I would think that it should help people to wake up to what's really going on in American-Iranian relations. Here's another quote from this article. A senior administration official that said there is no real command and control from the central government. Even if these guys don't attack us, Iran is ushering in a new Hezbollah era in Iraq, and we will have aided and abetted it. We're helping them do this. We're helping them to establish this. I mean, we were the ones who invited them in, so to speak, by eliminating their enemy in Saddam Hussein and failing to deal with them directly. We invited them in. Now we vacated the premises and now we're letting them fill the void. And now here we are working right alongside them and trying to rescue the situation some way or other. We're there to try to train the Iraqi police, but there they are watching us all the while. We're helping them in a way that I don't think anyone would have conceived of even 5-10 years ago.
I honestly think even the Iranians wouldn't have conceived that it would be this easy, especially with the United States helping them. I think they must be incredulous themselves. They want this. This is their goal. They want to dominate the Middle East. But I'm sure they are also incredulous at how much the United States is unwittingly helping them toward that goal.
I think you're absolutely right. Thank you, Anthony, for coming in and sharing this story with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anthony has written an article about this subject. It's called The Most Grotesque Manifestation of America's Appeasement of Iran. You can check it out online right now at thetrumpet.com.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
You've heard the story of Mount Vesuvius erupting. This catastrophe in AD 79 buried the people of Pompeii in a flash. Now, maybe you didn't know this, but that area today is actually quite nice. There's about 3.5 million Italians living in the shadow of that same volcano. Well, are they safe? It turns out Vesuvius could erupt again at any time, and these people know it, but they go on living there. Trumpet writer Robert Morley says that we all need to take a lesson from this situation. He's written an article about this in the August issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet. I have Robert here with me in the studio. Hello, Robert. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you.
Remind us of this history.
Sure. It's a dramatic episode in the history of mankind. And for us, it's actually an example that's preserved in time. It's locked away in time. It provides a microcosm of what the world was like back in 79 AD. Because as you mentioned, when Mount Vesuvius erupted and that pyroclastic flow, the hot ashes and cinders and bombs and superheated gas that flowed down the sides of the volcano, buried the cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum. And when it did, it preserved them perfectly for us. And it was so wiped out, and the destruction was so massive at that time that the people, the inhabitants of the area that survived, they fled, they left. The city was buried and they didn't come back for a long time. So what was there at that time was there to be found by archaeologists over 1,000 years later.
So what did they find?
The findings are close to unique in the world of archaeology, because what some of the diggers over there have found are, for example, the preserved remains, the actual forms and shapes of the inhabitants of Pompeii as they were dying, as they were being buried by the ash from the volcano. So what happened is, as the gas came roaring down the slopes and spilled over the walls of Pompeii and started burying people, it killed them quickly, some people not so quickly, but when it did, it buried them quickly with the ash. And when that ash covered them, it hardened. And as it hardened, the bodies naturally decayed over time, and it left these hollow shapes within the ashes. So fast forward 1,000 years, archaeologists are coming, they're doing digs in this area, they're making discoveries of these buildings, but they're also finding these cavities which represent the last shapes of people. Sometimes
almost like the mold around a sculpture, the way a sculpture would use a mold.
That's exactly what it is. They find these cavities, and that's how we see the shapes today. They would pour a plaster, a slurry, into these empty spaces. And the detail really is incredible. You can see the clothes that they wore. The clothes is gone. It's decayed, 1,000 years, the body's gone, but the ripples the clothes left in the ashes are still there. So when the plaster forms, you can still see the clothes they were wearing. You can see, even in some cases, you can see the expressions on their faces. So it gives a very insightful look into the people in Pompeii and their last moments.
So the people who are there today, what's the issue with them now? I mean, that's very dramatic history. They're certainly aware of it. They're living in the shadow of the same volcano that killed those people, but life goes on. What's the problem?
Well, Mount Vesuvius is still active. It's not an extinct volcano. Scientists know, history books know, it's erupted many times throughout history. The last eruption, I think, was during World War II, and there probably would have been more loss of life at that time, except many of the inhabitants actually fled away from the Allies that were advancing during that time, and actually the Allies did some pretty good work helping people out from that eruption. But several times throughout history, it has erupted. It erupted, I think, over 30 times since that initial first eruption that buried the inhabitants of Pompeii. So people know that this volcano erupts. City planners, Naples is built on the slopes, as you mentioned earlier, on the slopes of this volcano. And city planners, they know that it's going to erupt again. It's only a matter of time. Geologists tell them this. They can detect rumbles. They know there's magma building underneath the volcano in the magma chamber. And they know at some point this volcano is going to erupt again. They have their contingency plans. They have evacuation plans. City planners say there's about 500,000 people that live in what they call the red zone. And the red zone is this area surrounding the cone of the volcano, where if the volcano erupts, these people are likely going to die. I think the contingency plans require about 20 days to have a full evacuation, not nearly long enough to move everybody that's potentially within the blast zone. And if you talk to some geologists, if you talk to some of those city planners, read what they've written, They say things like, we know it's going to erupt. We know we can't move the people fast enough if we don't get the warning. And if the wind's blowing the wrong way, we could have massive casualties. Like, we're talking not just thousands of people, but tens of thousands, maybe even more, people dying when this volcano goes off.
And they're okay with it because...
Well, that's just human nature, isn't it? People understand that this is a risk. I mean, this is a defect in human nature, really. People know that it's going to erupt. City planners warn people before they move into neighborhoods. This is a volcano zone. And yet people choose to live on the very slopes of a mountain that we have the preserved bodies in casts of more than 1,000 people preserved in time in the same area. And the people of Pompeii aren't unique in this. You can look at Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, Clark Air Force Base, less than 14 miles from the slope, the cone of the volcano. You can look at Mount Krakatoa when that went off in Indonesia. It killed 30,000 people. People live on the slopes again. It's not a dead volcano. I mean, this is human nature.
But what you're saying is that this is kind of an allegory to the way that most of us tend to live, where we recognize there's this danger or that danger, something that truly is life-threatening, and yet we live on the side of the volcano anyway, or we just kind of ignore it.
I think you're right. It is.
Well, it's your point. I'm telling you your point.
Yeah, there is something that's unteachable sometimes with human nature. We look at history. We can understand what has happened in the past. We can, you know, gain this understanding academically. But it doesn't mean anything to us. It doesn't strike us the way it should. It doesn't trigger that fight or flight response that's triggered when there's an immediate danger, when the adrenaline rushes through. Looking at history, looking what has happened in the past, it sometimes it can seem like it's not real. But unfortunately, if you understand what history says, if you understand what the geologists are saying, it's going to happen again. So why do we choose to live on the slopes of a volcano?
Well, it's an interesting thing to consider, because on one hand, you could say, where is it safe? You know, like, there is so much danger, and there is this kind of, like, you almost become numb to a certain level of that. You know, you certainly see that, say, somebody who's living in a city that's high in crime or that type of thing, you come to expect a certain amount of that. That's just kind of part of life. You know, what is it like for the Israelis to live in the shadow of an Iranian nation that's seeking the nuclear bomb? You know, if that were just suddenly dropped there one day, then everybody would be really alarmed. But you live with it for a year or two or 10 or 50, and then you start thinking, well, you know, that's just part of life. And well, we've managed to get through all of these other crises. We'll be able to get through this as well, and maybe fail to see the gravity of the situation.
Yeah, it's kind of like the frog in a boiling pot. I think scientifically this might have been proved that it doesn't happen. But the analogy is that you have a frog in the water. You put him in the water, and there's a little bit of heat. There's no problem. Turn up the heat a little bit. The frog's used to it. A little more heat doesn't really matter. It's not so worrisome. It's just a little bit of heat. Add a little more heat, and the temperature builds and builds. But because it just happens slowly, you get dulled to the danger. You become complacent where you're at, and you don't see the actual what's actually threatening you from outside. If you had taken the frog and you just tossed him in a pot of water that's boiling, he'd jump right back out, or so the theory goes. I haven't tested that. Don't call the human rights or the animal rights activists on me. But I think that, you know, it's kind of a testament. It illustrates the way we function as human beings.
Well, you said this is a defect of human nature. And in one sense, it seems like it's a good thing that, say, if something terrible happens, your house burns down, you lose a loved one or something, or you're facing some real threat, and you go into that fight or flight mode, and there's that crisis you respond to, the fact that you're not from that point on in that crisis mode, that you do recover, that you do heal, that life does go on, and you're able to regain some semblance of normalcy, that's an important that's an important process. I mean, because their life does throw a lot of calamity at us in a lot of cases. What this is really about is when you are living with a life-threatening problem and you're just heedless to it. You're not paying attention, or you just think, well, yeah, it could go off, but we'll just deal with it when it comes. When you could actually take steps to protect yourself or to get out from underneath the shadow of that threat.
Right. I think that's kind of talking about two slightly different things. We can't go through life just worrying about every little thing and every little thing that has happened. And I think we are designed to heal when things go bad for us and we suffer traumas. You know, I think we are, as humans, designed. God has designed us so that we can recover from that. But we are also designed to take a look and be able to measure risks. We are able to look and judge on the danger, and we're designed that way. And I think that it's a testament to, as I said earlier, something that's just inherent in us that needs to constantly be challenged. We need to give ourselves a reality check and just make sure that we aren't becoming complacent to these types of things that are very real. Because when you look around at this world is a dangerous place. It's not a fun thing to think about. But you mentioned earlier some of the cities we live in, crime rates. Now, people choose not to live in Ferguson. Why do certain people today, if you ask them, would you want to live in Ferguson? Would you want to go to Baltimore and live in those areas where there was these riots? And, you know, there's militarized police coming in and there was people looting and destroying businesses and burning. They would say, no, I don't want to live in. There's no way I would take my family with me and go and buy a house in that part of Baltimore or Ferguson, or you pick your city, South Central, the Bronx, wherever it is. And that would be fine. And we wouldn't question that. We'd think that's a good decision. But what happens X number of years from now? Or, you know, we know that the volcano erupted in the past. We know it's going to erupt again. You know, where's the breakdown in that understanding?
Well, as you bring out in this article, Jesus Christ prophesied, knowing this aspect of human nature, he said that there are going to be people who just get complacent and they're not watching. He says, I want you to watch. I want you to be ready. This is all going to happen in an hour that you're not thinking of it, and it's going to hit you like a ton of bricks if you're not really vigilant and paying attention. So don't get overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and the cares of this life, or it's going to hit you unawares. Really important point to think about.
Well, that was really why I wrote this article. I mean, the example of the people who died in Pompeii and their bodies remain for us, you know, as a warning of what can happen here. The same sort of warnings are out there in different ways when it comes to where we are in terms of Bible prophecy, where we are in terms of the nearness of Jesus Christ's return to this earth. We should be able to look around. We should be able to see world events and know how close we are to that time, and know that we are getting very close to that time in history if we're watching. And that's the warning that Jesus Christ gave us, you know, in Matthew 24 and other places, of making sure that we're watching and aware of the days that we live in.
The title of the article, A Lesson for Today from Pompeii, you can find it on thetrumpet.com or in our August edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine. Thanks, Robert, for coming in.
You're welcome.
This is Trumpet Hour.
It's time for Q&A. I have our social media manager, David Vigil, here with me.
Hello.
And I still have Robert Morley, because he's going to help us a little bit today as well. David takes questions submitted from our listeners and our readers, from the website and from all of our online sources, and fires them at me. And let's give it a go.
Okay, well, today we have a question that came through email, and it was over Robert Morley's article on Gazprom's dangerous new Nord Stream gas pipeline to Germany. And this is from AHB. He or she says, why does pumping the gas to Germany first mean Russia can easier attack Eastern Europe? If anything, it would make it harder to shut off their gas than it is right now, because that would mean they would have to shut off gas to Germany to deprive anyone else. The real reason that Russia wants to shut down the pipelines to Ukraine is because the Ukrainians can't pay for gas and they have a history of stealing supply that was meant for Europe.
So I'm going to allow the author to respond because he's right here with us.
Seems legitimate to me.
Well, I think the easy answer to this is follow the pipelines. Where do the pipelines run? And right now, the pipelines run through Ukraine into Western Europe. So anytime that Russia has a problem with Ukraine, if Ukraine doesn't pay, just like the reader said, which is a very valid point, there have been times in the past where Ukraine has used its position as the home to the pipelines as a bargaining tool with Russia and said, you need to give us a better deal on the gas or we're not going to let the gas go through to these other countries. And Russia has responded and there's been tit for tat. But Russia hasn't ever had a very good way of dealing with this. But as the article brings out, when this new pipeline is constructed, the first phase has already been completed. It takes gas directly from Russia, follows the Baltic Sea and into Germany and bypasses Ukraine. And when this pipeline is twinned, then there will be absolutely no need for the old pipelines that run through Ukraine. So what this means for the region, what this means for Europe as a whole, is that the next time Russia gets in a dispute with Ukraine, and once Nord Stream is completed, then it can shut off the gas that comes through the old pipelines and still supply the rest of Western Europe. So looking at this from Ukraine's perspective, does this make Ukraine more safe or less safe? It makes them less safe because now Russia can invade Ukraine. It could attack Ukraine. It could be in a pricing dispute with Ukraine and say the gas goes off. It's wintertime. You freeze if you don't pay. And we can still supply the rest of Europe. So hopefully that makes sense what I said. And if not, maybe you can ask me again and I can try explaining it a different way.
they can cut off the gas to Ukraine without affecting Germany. So it's kind of like, you know, shutting the power off to one room in the house rather than shutting down the power to the whole house and everybody being affected. They can be pretty selective in the way they use this as a weapon.
That's a great description. It has given Russia the ability to use its gas as a precision weapon, as you said, specific.
Have you got another question for us?
Yes, I do. This is actually a question from last Trumpet Hour, and it's about the court's decision on homosexual marriage. It's from Ronald Pete. He says, thank you, Mr. Hilliker, for this eye-opening article about the court's decision on marriage. This shows that the rule of law is being destroyed in this nation. Soon, what other freedoms will be taken away?
In this case, the court actually stripped states of the right to define marriage on their own, the way that they wanted to define it. It ended the debate that was taking place within the states. What other freedoms are they going to take to themselves? It's a really good question. It's probably the thing that we're watching. It's like we're all kind of spectators to this grand drama that's playing out on a national level. What is the next freedom that is going to be taken away from us? We've seen a lot of attention paid to, say, greater incursions into our privacy in the way of surveillance and mining of data, private data. What else, Robert?
Parental rights is another one. You can look at examples where communities and judges have given school districts the right to inject contraceptives into minors without their parents' permission.
Just a lot of elements of the liberal social agenda that are being pushed on people, where they're, it's come up in a few news items where people don't have the freedom to go into a public bathroom without fear of someone of the opposite sex being in there because of transgender issues.
Really, the sky's the limit. It's become a rule of the lawyers, as somebody said, as opposed to the rule of the law. Where does that end? Well, apparently five people is what it takes at the Supreme Court to decide where it ends.
Yeah, I could also see as rulings come out more and more over time that potentially too churches could lose their tax exemption status as well.
And, yeah, we talked about that in that article, the fact that every single point of contact between church and state, you know, we talked about the quote from that individual who said that basically the church is surrounded by the state, and it's there's a potential point of conflict at every single point there. Tax exempt status makes it possible for a church to exist, you know, basically on donations and that type of thing. And if they lose that, if the state says, well, we don't like what you're teaching on this or this or this, and strips that away from them, then that makes them, that really hurts them. But you can also look at things like housing, where anyone who's in public in business is suddenly subject to punishment by the state because they don't follow the orthodox position out of personal belief. You know, you can foresee there being a whole lot of areas where people are being pressured into certain behavior by the state that basically says, your view on this subject is no longer tenable in a secularist state.
You could look at California. It's very topical right now. Immunizations. They've passed a law they're trying to force, or they've eliminated the opt-out, the religious opt-out for parents who don't want their children vaccinated for religious reasons. State says that's no longer valid. We don't believe that that's valid. You want to go to public school? You have to get vaccinated. That's all there is to it.
It's a really interesting topic, and we'll definitely continue to watch it very closely. Thanks for the questions, David. Thanks, Robert, for sticking around for us. You can send us your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks for coming in, gentlemen.
Thanks for having me.
Have a good day.
It's time for today's last word.
Our life is frittered away by detail, wrote Thoreau. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. I say, let your affairs be as two or three, not 100 or 1,000. He wrote that in 1854. What would this man think of the life-frittering details that consume us in the Twitter age? Contemplating this, I recently picked up Farrar Fenton's translation of the Bible in my study. A friend gave me a copy a while back, but it wasn't until that morning that I realized I was in possession of something quite awesome and inspiring. At the beginning of this massive volume is a note to my inquiring friends from the translator. It is Mr. Fenton's explanation of why he, a British businessman in the 19th century, undertook the mammoth project of translating the entire Bible. It's a testament to the manly sense of duty, determination, sacrifice, perseverance, and big-mindedness behind this book. It truly stirred my imagination. Fenton paraphrases a Professor Karl Baer of Munich, who taught, "The best established doctrine of historical philosophy was that all the power, prosperity, and mental energy of a race or nation sprang from and lived by its religion. That when the religion ceased to be its faith, that is, its energizing principle, the intellect, power, vigor, and prosperity of that race or nation died away in proportion and ultimately perished, both mentally and physically." How true, and how painfully relevant in our aggressively secularist age. Fenton then says this, "The position the British race has won in the world is founded upon the religion, which takes as its origin the Bible. And therefore, I am convinced that with the decay of faith in the scriptures, our national vigor and prosperity as a race will waste away, not only in the British Isles, but as with all races, in every state or colony sprung from them. Consequently, I will try at least to avert or retard so great a catastrophe and calamity to the whole of mankind. I have decided, God helping me, to execute the work you see I am doing." Why translate the entire Bible into modern English? Fenton said, my object is to try and save the British race from decay and dissolution by restoring to it the vital element of faith in revelation. For unless its faith is revived, our doom is certain. I find several things about this astounding. The fact that this man recognized so clearly the importance of Bible-based faith to national health and prosperity, even survival, that he particularly believed this to be true of Britain and its empire and of America, that he knew the decline of these nations would be a catastrophe and a calamity to the world. In 1910, when Fenton wrote this introduction to his Bible translation, he quoted a critic of his work who said, "Nobody cares a halfpenny for the Bible." A century later, that indifference has turned to outright hatred. We live in a Britain and an America that are increasingly making adherence to biblical truth a crime punishable by the state. This all made Fenton's words stir me as I read them, but there's something more. I'm also deeply impressed that this man possessed such determined focus to try to single-handedly prevent or at least delay this catastrophe using the means he believed God inspired him to. Fenton perceived a need for a modern translation of the Bible. He recognized this was a task nobody else would undertake. So what did he do? He got started. And then he didn't stop until he finished. He wrote this, "I saw the need also, not only as a student, but from intercourse with all classes of my countrymen, and God inspired me with courage to undertake it, and with inborn perseverance during a period of 50 years to carry it through by devoting every leisure moment of a busy commercial life to the preparation for and execution of that one object." It was in 1853, at the same time that Thoreau was walking the woods of Walden Pond, that Fenton started this mammoth undertaking. He finished in 1903 at the age of 71. It's astonishing what singular devotion to an important task can yield. How critical it is that we prune out those life-frittering details and make the very most of the brief time we possess. For today, too, there is a great work to be done. In the shadow of looming catastrophe, it demands courage, perseverance, and devotion to that one object. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of another Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. You can read the stories that we've talked about on the program today. You can get a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. Send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Follow us on Twitter @@thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook or Google Plus just by searching Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guests today, Richard Palmer, Anthony Chibataway, and Robert Morley. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from David Burge. Get a college degree is to education as put stuff in your mouth is to nutrition. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.